He left the room, and this time he came back completely head to toe naked. And he's a big guy. And he's between me and the apartment door. He said, "Well, if you won't give me a massage, will you at least show me your breasts? Will you lift up your shirt and show me your breasts?" And then he sort of had his hands out and was doing that back and forth dance from side to side to not let me pass. And so now I'm trapped.
Actress Catherine Kendall telling the New York Times how Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed her when she was in her early 20s. Kendall is one of around two dozen women who have so far accused the now ousted studio executive of rape or sexual harassment. In addition to her, Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, Rosanna Arquette, Mira Sorvino, Ashley Judd, Rose McGowan, and many others. In the aftermath of these revelations, soul searching has begun around Hollywood. How could this have gone on for so long? Why didn't people speak out? Would it have helped if there were more women in positions of power in film and TV? What are the lessons from this, and how might the industry act on them? Well, here to help answer these and many other questions are three women with a wealth of experience in film and television. Kathy Schulman is an Academy Award-winning producer and president and CEO of Well Entertainment. She's also the president of Women in Film. Welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you back. Tracy Twinkie Bird, casting director and producer. Welcome back to you.
Hi, thank you very much.
Great to have you. And also joining us, actress and author Amber Tamblyn. Welcome back to you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Glad to say you've all been on the show before.
Yes.
Okay, so Amber, let's begin with you. There was a story in The Guardian where an English actress, her name is Romola Garai, I think that's how you pronounce it, talks about how she ended up alone at the age of 18 with Harvey Weinstein. And she says, "I didn't feel like I had the right to complain. At the time, I understood myself to be a commodity and that my value in the industry rested almost exclusively on the way I looked. And I didn't really think of myself to be any more than that." You have been in the industry since you were very small and you're older than 18 now, but does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, I started acting when I was 11 and I'm 34 now. So I've been doing it for two decades. And, you know, I can say I've it's actually very common. I've read a lot of things about people saying like, well, why were they in a room, in a hotel room with a producer anyway? It's really common to have meetings in hotel rooms. What's shocking or not common, I thought, was the etiquette that would happen in those rooms. But I completely can understand that. You know, when you're green in this business, when you're new, when you're first starting out, and you kind of get sucked into this idea that, well, this is how I get a job. This is the way things work. And, it's interesting to see who came out and who he has had these relationships with. But to me, it seems like a common case where it is, one, someone who's just trying to get into the business, and two, they're a little bit naive about how that works, or scared, or perhaps shy, even introverted. And it seems like he really went after women that were those particular types. And any women, for instance, like an Angelina Jolie, who just put her foot down, I feel like that was sort of the anomaly outside of what he was used to going after.
Right. Although he did try, apparently.
Yeah,
her.
Right. But she sort of shut him down pretty quickly.
And right.
I guess what I'm trying to say is I think it's terrifying for some women, especially when you're young. I mean, I know I've definitely had advances and all kinds of things put towards me when I was younger and wouldn't know how to, you know, would sort of not know how to deal with those things and sort of grin and bear it and then move on and think, well, that's just kind of the way it is.
You know? A similar casting couch situation?
Yeah. Well, it's passed down wisdom between women, it's generational that, oh, that's just how men are. And you just have to watch out for those types of men. And it's even come out, I think, that, you know, that a lot of actresses have told other actresses or people, you know what, just whatever you do, don't be in a room alone with him. He's a creep. That was sort of the attitude, the sort of known thing. But I don't think that I knew that he was a rapist. That was not a word that I ever heard. I didn't realize it went that far. But the fact that I even allowed that, that's the shared wisdom, right? That I even said like, oh, whatever, he like touched a butt here and there. That's on me. And that's so, so true of how we see the attitude and the physicality of how people treat women in our business.
And Tracy, you're shaking, nodding your head. Yeah, I know she's talking about.
I just because it's true. What it is that you're saying is true. And when you get to a certain, there's a certain point or a certain level and that we have become accustomed to. But like she's saying, when it got to that next point, and it's unfortunate. But one of the things that I share with actors, I will correct them right away when they say, I'm nobody and I came to be somebody. I'm like, ah, everybody's somebody. There's
but
no
have
nobody.
You ever had to warn people, you're a casting director,
I
you
am.
Ever had to warn people, oh, well, watch yourself when you're talking to this producer, this director?
You know, originally in New York, I started out doing music video and managing models and dancers. And there was a fashion editor at a magazine that I had to warn the guys about because he was a predator to the guys. Mm-hmm. So the guys had to deal with that as well. So it wasn't just women. So it became a conversation. Remember what I said. Mm-hmm. Okay, handle yourself. Be prepared. Because you want people to really be present in their body. And be prepared. You know you have to go in for this person, and and you're going in for a job, and you're going in with the right intentions. But unfortunately, there are people who have the wrong intentions.
Kathy, you are a producer, and you've been in this business for a long time. And so I imagine that you operate a lot differently than a producer like Harvey Weinstein would in terms of auditioning talent. But have you heard all of these stories for a long time about him and about perhaps other men?
I hadn't heard the extent of these accusations against Harvey until this all blew up. I had certainly both heard and experienced, you know, very rough behavior by Harvey and a sort of sense of dismissiveness, particularly to women. But no, I wasn't aware that things to this level were happening. You know, when dealing with discrimination, the root issue is that people fail to speak up because they have a fear of being anything on a spectrum from being annoying to being fired. But there's no way to deal with this other than to speak out. So I've tried to be very vocal throughout my career when I see this kind of thing happen. And frankly, I've suffered for it. You know, it's made it harder for me to work. Yeah, it's made it harder for me to work. I'm sort of one of those scary women who notices and talks. But
are you talking about a specific incident where you lost your job or financing or anything like that?
Yeah, I think I've lost most of the jobs that I've lost because of discriminatory behavior and then my lack of willingness to play ball. You know, but I've always felt like nobody can touch what's really you, and you move on and do things on your own way.
Hmm. Amber, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that said, I'm done with not being believed. And, you know, we were talking about why people didn't come forward about this before. But what happens when you try to raise these issues when you're working on set and maybe you're in an uncomfortable position? What happens when you go to the person, the man in charge?
Well, how long is your program? Four hours? Is it 4 hours? Because I have a lot to say on
that.
It's
a lifetime.
Again, I think it really, it's different for every show and every, I think, acting experience that I've ever had. And certainly, I know that when I was younger, I was always made to feel like this little girl who didn't know anything, didn't know what she was doing, and certainly didn't have, you know, a right to sort of speak her mind about something with veteran television showrunners or film directors or whatever that was. And as I got older, I was able to really hold my ground and certainly my creative process and my creative voice. But, you know, it's really interesting. There is definitely a sense of women sort of in this very quiet way in our business and I suppose in the world of just quietly being marginalized. And I even feel like this moment right now is a lot of people looking at us going, oh, this is sweet. Let's let them have their moment to like come out and get somebody bad. And I just don't know how deeply this industry wants to change itself. And it needs that. It needs allies. And, you know, to that end, it needs male allies. We need more men to be talking about it. It's so important. And I've seen so much on Twitter and social media and in the news saying, why aren't actresses coming forward? Why haven't these people come forward and supported these few women in the very beginning when it was just Rose McGowan and Ashley Judd? And, you know, it really is upsetting and painful to hear that because, you know, you're asking more victims who have already been run over by the train train to stay there on the tracks and wait for the train to come back and roll over them again. You know, I feel fundamentally that men who are in a position of power in this business, they have the ability to change it more than we do. Not just us. It's not just on us. It's not just on women to, you know, we're supporting each other. That's what we got right now. And we need other people to step in and do that as well.
Well, there's also the narrative of the he said, she said. And, well, who knows what really happened behind closed doors.
In the room.
In the room. Yeah. And, you know, there are many sides to a story. And let's just move on.
Women have nothing to gain and everything to lose by coming forward. I've said that repeatedly. That is a mantra that everybody knows. Yep. Any woman who's ever come forward, there's nothing in it for us.
Yep, nothing.
There's nothing.
Get ripped to shreds.
Ripped to shreds.
You literally get ripped to shreds. They want to go back in your history. They want to go back in your whole life and pull everything out. You're absolutely right.
And they're like, oh, but look now, you're doing KCRW, you're doing interviews about it. It's like, you think this is enjoyable to come on here and not talk about something that I'm creatively doing, a film I did, a book I'm writing, like anything else? You think this is what I want to come and talk about?
Right.
I mean, people have a really warped perception of what they think women's values are and what their intentions are. And it's warped at every level.
So you have been pretty vocal. And recently you've talked about being harassed by James Woods when you were 16 years old, being invited to go to Vegas with him. And then he responded when you told him
really
your age.
Really missed out.
All the better, right, is what he said to you?
Yeah.
And so what has been the reaction that now that you've published these stories, have people come after you on Twitter?
Not really. And I don't check like comments or things like that. The thing that's sad about that is that James Woods did it and didn't know who I was. I was on a soap opera at that time. So like I wasn't a particularly known actress, which I imagine are the type of women that he and predators like him pick up. And so I had to call him out on that and say, you didn't realize that that's who I was at that time. And then later I became more known. But I think that that's sort of the jump that men make is they immediately get defensive. They immediately don't want to be accused of doing something because the behavior is so endemic to our culture. There's no reason for them to question it or to look at it in a wrong way.
So when you're talking about whether or not things will change, what about consequences? Harvey Weinstein has gone off to Europe to be rehabilitated. What needs to happen, Kathy?
Well, I think this is a crucial area, you know, that we need to focus on, which is that we need to have lasting legal penalties that are applied without compromise, bias, or settlement. And the process that's become so normal in this industry is that a problem happens, a person speaks up, and then that person is given money or some kind of severance or potentially even a job, and it's in return for shutting up. It's become the custom. And what's happening is if you don't shut up, then this will be worse. And, you know, I asked a couple of days ago, why is it that these human resources people at this company let this happen for so long? Because I'm very focused on the enablers. And somebody that I know who knows somebody who's in the human resources department there at the Weinstein Company said, well, we have non-disclosure agreements. And so I went into my desk and I grabbed a couple of my employment contracts from various companies in Hollywood. And I certainly don't know what the Weinstein Company one says. But I looked at my own agreements and I thought, you know what? There is not a thing in this agreement that says that I cannot speak up when it's an issue of legal or civil liberties. This is not true. I'm going to guess that this way that lawyers have taught us, and I've heard it in so many meetings, in so many corporate settings, that if you say anything about this company or anyone in it, you have broken your confidentiality agreement. Well, I question that. How is it possible that human resources and legal and business affairs and all the and publicists and everybody else involved is covering this stuff up? Like, this could have stopped years ago if somebody had spoken up. And I'm sure that that person or those people were afraid of losing a job. But we have to figure out a way to stop this process and also educate people about what their actual employment contracts say, because I have a really hard time believing that if your company breaks the law, you have to be silent about it.
Well, they probably drew up new settlement agreement, NDAs, right?
Instead of, yeah, well, the that's the thing. Once it happens and there's an issue and you bring it up, then you sign a settlement and you sign an NDA, or what we call a quit claim. I've signed quite a few myself. And it's something that you do to get yourself out of a mess. But does it help change the system? Does it even help you? I don't know. I don't think any amount of money or any pathetic version of a lesser opportunity cures the overall problem of discrimination.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're talking about the Harvey Weinstein scandal, the fallout, and what's happening in Hollywood with three women: Kathy Shulman, Academy Award-winning producer and president and CEO of Well Entertainment, also the president of Women in Film; Tracy Twinkie Bird, casting director and producer and also actress and author; Amber Tamblyn. Tracy, I wanted to ask you, you are an African-American woman. We've been talking a lot in recent years about the lack of diversity in Hollywood,
yes,
and Oscar's so white and all that kind of thing. This situation, this Harvey Weinstein situation, and the intimidation that actresses feel, the casting couch situation, must be doubly difficult for Black women trying to get a foothold in Hollywood because it is so much more difficult for them.
Huh. Well, I can say this. There are challenges for sure, and my feeling about this situation, in particularly, is that we need to know and understand that we are empowered in numbers, and we all need to come together because it's not just women and this man. Because it's a larger situation. There's more than one.
Mm-hmm.
We all know there's more than one. There's more than 10. So the conversation needs to be larger. It is an issue of oppression. And that is something that this country was built on, is oppression. And we really need to have that conversation and all of us come together, because people of color and women, we are all being oppressed in different ways. And we need to come together and have that dialogue.
Kathy, you have spent many years trying to get more women in positions of power in Hollywood. Is that the key to this, is having more women do what you do, produce movies, so that women don't have to, you know, be at the mercy of the old power dynamic and what can be perverted in that hotel room?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. And definitely I have been working, you know, over the last 15 years, and specifically with the organization Women in Film.
Love them.
Thank you.
There's applause happening in the room.
Yes.
Now, we've been doing the same thing the same way for a long time. And what we've basically been doing is telling the stories of men and boys. And men and boys have both made them and received them. And women are left with what? And the reason I bring this up in getting to the harassment question is that, first and foremost, the only way that people are going to better understand each other is to see images and stories of various different kinds of people of all diversities around the world. To make that happen, we have to have diverse decision-making tables, first and foremost. The way that Hollywood works in the end of the day is that certain people can make the decisions about which content to finance. And if the people making those decisions aren't diverse, you will not get diverse decisions.
Absolutely.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. And so that's where we start, those decision-making tables. Then it comes down to the hiring. You know, we have to hire blind to gender, blind to other diversities, because if we don't do that, the same process happens. You're just basically propelling this male gaze, right? And then what does it create? It creates an environment of stories that empower men, that don't empower women, mm-hmm. that have poor roles for women, that women feel they should play because they want to act. And now they're suddenly thinking, as Amber was saying earlier, that they're not of worth or value. And if I'm an actress, it just means I have to be pretty because that's what my role is going to be anyway. And if I'm pretty, then I need to be approved by men. And to be approved and by men is to be harassed by men. And it just becomes this cycle. So I very much believe that this work is about bringing both men and women into this discussion.
I mean, it's not just Hollywood, though, right?
No,
in fact, a friend of mine who's an author, Porchista Kapoor, just tweeted something. She's a wonderful, amazing novelist, and she said, you know, all of this makes me wonder if the literary world is going to have the strength to call out predators in our business now. you know, I feel like it's across all boards, and now sort of everybody is looking at their own business or their own, you know, creative world and saying, okay, who among us are those people? Are those power players? Are those usually men that have taken advantage of women, or also sort of taken away our stories and our ability to have ownership over our own truths and lives?
So the casting couch, as we've heard, has been around forever, right? Young, beautiful starlets have been at the mercy of powerful male executives forever in Hollywood and elsewhere. Why is this now becoming unacceptable now? Why now? What is the moment? If you could just all weigh in on that and why you think it's happening right now.
I mean, I go towards this, not only the state of the world, but in specific, the state of our country. And this might sound like a crazy leap, but to me, it's about Donald Trump. I fundamentally believe that in the face of such a racist woman hater, frankly, somebody who has been accused of sexual assault and still got into the White House anyway, that it has inflamed a lot of these really painful conversations and these dialogues that have sort of been happening on this more shallow level about racism, about sexism and misogyny. And he has forced it into the light. That's what is happening now. And so we're looking at that. We're looking at everything that happened in last year's election and the way a female candidate was treated by him, even in the face of these tapes coming out about him grabbing private parts, and even in the face of him bringing the women that her husband had affairs with to a debate to sit in front of her while she debated. I mean, all of these things, it's cumulative to me. And so I feel like maybe we were like at a breaking point and then it broke. And here we are on the other side of that, just saying, we are unanimously done. We are unanimously done.
But 48% of Caucasian women voted for him.
Yes, that is
true. So that's an issue, because 94% of African American women voted for Clinton.
Well,
we didn't get together.
As I've said, you know who hates women more than Donald Trump?
Other women.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It could also be, I don't mean to give any excuses to those women who voted for Trump, because I find it really, really impossible to believe. But, you know, it could have to do with the fact that when you've been victimized for a long time by a paternalistic culture, you start to think it's
conditioning.
Conditioning. And this felt like daddy was going to save, you know, the day. And that's just horrible. But I do think that one of the things that Amber just touched upon is that there's a lack of fractionalization that we've experienced before in various different groups who have felt that they've been the victims of you know, discrimination, prejudice, and various other, well, let's start with those two. And I think that there is something that's been going on ever since this president was elected that has caused everybody to sort of drop their details in a weird way and to look at the big trend, which is that people need to have voices, that civil rights are important,
yes,
that we cannot be abused and harassed, and that we have to be able to make this world we live in the best that we all collectively can make it. And I think that there is a surge of that kind of thing going on right now. And we needed, frankly, to hit rock bottom to start to pull ourselves back up.
Absolutely. But 100%. Going back to something that Amber said earlier and that we touched upon was about changing and shifting the narrative, and something that you would think, and in particularly in the African-American community, but something that you would think, a film that you would think would be incredibly empowering, Hidden Figures, which was completely and totally changed and reconfigured by a man in order to tell a story. Low-hanging fruit. You had to write in a white savior in order to... These women, these black women... Don't change the narrative and just say women, because they were black women in NASA in the 40s and the 50s. That in and of itself, they saved themselves. And you're not empowering them by creating another character in order to bring in to say, I'm going to knock down the all colored bathroom sign and I'm going to. And unfortunately, we live in a culture, much like you said, where everything is going to be on the screen. Who's going to read the book now? to find out the truth.
It's so true.
About these women. So we have to have women writers and producers and directors, such as all of these filmmakers in the room, in order to tell the stories and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. Tell the truth, because we were there for each other and we're there for ourselves. And to true empowerment is in the truth.
Do you think that this is going to actually cause a shift? A lot of people say, oh, well,
yes,
you know,
I do.
Things might just go back to normal after this dies down.
I do. And to this end, I really want to say that there are a lot of really, really great men in our business. I know for me that after I wrote that op-ed, that a lot of people reached out to me and said, whether it was first ADs, whether it was camera operators, directors, the show creator, Hart Hansen, who created Bones, is a great example. Quentin Tarantino, all sort of said, wow, I don't think I had been thinking about this before. It was never on my mind, and I don't think I'll ever run a set the same way again.
Although Quentin Tarantino has said nothing about Harvey Weinstein.
Give him time. I was just texting with him, and I, you know, Harvey Weinstein did every single one of his films. He's in a state of shock. Mm. And I have to respect that. As painful as it is for everybody, it's very painful for people who also, you know, had the same idea of like, oh, he must have pinched butts here and there. And now we're seeing the truth, the magnitude of what's going on. You know, and I think give it time. A lot of people are sort of processing it. And as you can see, it took other women a couple days to come out and talk more about it. You know, things don't just happen immediately. This business is sort of, it's all trickling. Mm.
I mean, but this sort of goes to your Hidden Figures point that it takes a man to change the business. Like, it's got to be men to say, no, enough. We're going to be the saviors here.
I don't know. I'm hopeful that what Amber is saying is going to be true, that we can have a seismic shift. But I sadly have been around so long that I'm not quite as convinced. I think one of the dangers that keeps happening in sort of repetitively is that we have these moments of sort of togetherness or enlightenment about these kinds of issues, and then they're easily brushed under the rug again.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
We heard from Amber Tamblyn, actress and author, Tracy Twinkie Bird, casting director and producer, and Kathy Shulman, Academy Award-winning producer and president and CEO of Well Entertainment and president of Women in Film. Coming up, how Los Angeles is becoming a place where dance matters.
I see a great potential, you know, and I think this is the moment for dance is really happening. You know, this is the moment.
I'll speak with choreographer Benjamin Millepied about his new home for his company, LA Dance Project, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Benjamin Millepied rose to fame as a principal dancer and choreographer at the New York City Ballet. His big break came in the movie Black Swan. He choreographed and starred in the film alongside Natalie Portman, who later became his wife. After Black Swan, he moved to L.A. and started a new dance company called L.A. Dance Project. But just a couple of years and a handful of performances later, Millepied left L.A. to become artistic director of the Paris Opera Ballet. That's one of the most prestigious dance companies in the world. While he was in Paris, he just could not stop thinking about Los Angeles.
I love L.A. so much visually, you know, obviously with this light, I just find myself constantly looking up, you know, and there's all this color. And when I was in Paris, I found myself, you know, the most beautiful city in the world, never looking up.
So Millepied resigned from the Paris Opera Ballet and returned to L.A. to focus on L.A. Dance Project. Now the company is moving to a new space in the Arts District with plans to become a true L.A. dance company. I spoke with Millepied about that and his vision for dance in Los Angeles.
You become a home company the day that you have a strong presence and you perform regularly. And the only way to do that was for us to have our own home and our own performance space. But, you know, my idea is that this space will also be a place where we will nurture, you know, groups that exist, you know, here in LA, you know, incubate groups, have artists in residence, young choreographers. You know, the idea is to really have this place that can help the scene of dance, you know, grow in Los Angeles, because there's some really exciting things going on. I mean, there's been, you know, interesting things going on for a long time, but now you also have this, you know, the universities that are the, you know, like USC with Jody Gates William Forsythe's program. Mm-hmm. They're fantastic students, you know, a whole new generation of dancers.
There's a whole new dance program at USC, undergraduate dance program.
That's really exciting, and that's, I think, really forward thinking. There's a ballet school at Colburn led by Jennifer Ringer and James Fayette, and now there's a new dean of dance, an old friend of mine, Dimitri Chambless at CalArts, who's doing incredible things. So you have all this momentum now. I see a great potential, you know, and I think this is the moment for dance is really happening. You know, this is the moment.
Okay, so if this is the moment, why? Why is this the moment now? And can you also describe how you would characterize the LA dance scene as it is now?
Well, this kind of space has been missing. The thing about LA, and it's true of dance, but also in other fields, there's a lot of interesting things going on in different places and small organizations and so forth. Why now? I mean, I think, you know, coming from New York, I was there for 20 years, where I felt that the city had become saturated, you know, very, very hard. Minorities have been, you know, pushed out from Manhattan, and it's a different city. It's a completely different city, and it's very difficult anywhere to finance the arts. So I find, you know, in Los Angeles, where, you know, I feel daily confronted with, you know, diversity and, you know, a very exciting and vibrant community. And there's, you know, it's not that there's no precedent, because dance has existed for a long time in Los Angeles, but we're still a little bit like the visual artists in the 60s, you know. It's like this moment now, especially also with the political climate, you know, with what's, you know, with the role that California is taking on, you know, this openness that we have, we can just create without having to worry about, you know, what the so-and-so might say, the New York Times or the this or the that or the difficulty, you know. So there's a kind of excitement. And I see some exciting talent. I mean, I think there's also a whole generation of dancers who learn dancing on YouTube. You know, it's very different from my generation. You know, so I think it's great to have this sort of freedom and to actually just gather a group of people and collaborate together. And, you know, my sense now too is, as I'm reaching out to more artists, is everyone wants to do things that are really meaningful, you know, and have, you know, set a tone and say something about, you know, take a stance on what's happening and want to be more involved. And so that's exciting.
So you're saying that dance can be and should be at this moment political.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, I've premiered at the end of the month with American Ballet Theatre in New York. And, you know, there's no chance that I can make a work that's disconnected to how I feel on a daily basis.
I want to get back to the scene in L.A., the dance scene in L.A., because it feels to me that you're right, that something is happening. What with all these schools starting new programs and all these different dance projects, it still seems to me diffuse, that it's hard to sort of put your finger on what the LA dance scene is. But it also seems that a lot of the scene is kind of commercial. It comes up through maybe videos or backup dancers for musicians.
Well, there's a ton of commercial talent. You know, what's happened with this generation, I would say, of dancers who've learned from, you know, dancing from YouTube is that actually, you know, they have incredible virtuosity, musicality, you know, a complex understanding of movement. And I find that, you know, I find that incredibly exciting to watch. And you know, there's a sincerity to it. That's why you want to be able to also say, well, listen, don't just stay in the commercials, but you're very talented. Come and, you know, work in a studio and use space differently. And here are some ballet dancers. And, you know, here is also someone you can talk to about what it's like to structure a dance. And let's see what happens. I think it's a matter of time now. Things don't happen overnight. And I think, you know, you will see the LA dance scene growing. The issue is that, you know, we're not painters. We're not, we don't just need brushes and, you know, canvas. You know, you need studio, you need dancers, you need money. You know, we need more dance and more music in our lives. And there's, you know, dance can have this tremendous impact for communities. And I think it's more than ever important that LA has this vibrant dance scene.
So you are classically trained, ballet dancer, choreographer. And I'm wondering if you have been influenced personally in terms of your own dance style and how you choreograph by what you've been talking about in terms of these kids you see on YouTube or kids you see here in LA.
I have a very unique background with what, you know, because actually I was born in France, but I was raised in Senegal. So I really started with African dance. I mean, for years. So I danced African daily until I was like 12 years old. You know, I have a relationship to my upper body, my back, the way I move my head, my arms, rhythm, you know, that has nothing to do with ballet. So ballet I came on later, but that's a very important influence. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, when I am a ballet choreographer working for a ballet company, makes me a kind of not stand out, but rather, you know, I'm not one of these ballet choreographers. I don't quite fit in what we expect ballet choreographers to be, because there's layers of influences that you don't usually have. You know, ballet really could be faster. I want more and more personally to make things more intricate and change the quality of movement all the time in my pieces. And that's what these dancers can do. You know, these dancers that are not necessarily formally trained can do.
And is that also a way to attract a younger audience, an audience that isn't perhaps generally drawn to classical ballet?
Well, you have to create work that's relevant to people now. And that's by not creating works that look like they could have been made 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Mm. And then you're also directing a movie next year.
Yes.
Carmen.
Yep.
An adaptation of Carmen.
The reason I chose Carmen is it's an opera that I grew up with, and you know, it was very popular as a kid, and I was interested in revisiting the classic tragedy and adapting it to a Carmen that's reinvented, because, you know, like many 19th century stories, Carmen is one that's been written by men who don't know anything about women. So my Carmen is a very interesting woman, and she's not the devil, and she's just a woman seeking freedom. You know, a Mexican whose mother, you know, lives in a very dangerous village. The movie opens on a mother passing away, and she crosses the border. And that night is arrested by volunteer border patrol. So the whole story is very much, meaningful for this moment in time. The lovers on the run, this volunteer border patrol and Carmen, you know, driver went to the desert and to LA. So, yeah. So it's all new music. We're not using the Bizet.
So it sounds like it's just Carmen in name only, in a way.
What?
It's like Carmen in name only, because it seems so different from the Bizet
opera. It is different, but I think that's the opportunity. It's the opportunity to reinvent the story in a contemporary way and for it to be authentic and to talk about subjects that we should really be thinking about.
Do you think if you had stayed in New York or Paris even, you would have done that?
No, I mean, that was, to me, that I know that at least the next years will be shared between, you know, making films and making dances. You know, that's just the photography, moving image, you know, light, you know, there are things that I'm incredibly in love with.
Benjamin Millepied, he's the founder and artistic director of the LA Dance Project, and the company is performing three works by Millepied at the Wallace Annenberg Center for Performing Arts from November 2nd through the 4th. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, I'll speak with a couple of LA's geniuses about winning a MacArthur grant. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. L.A. is full of geniuses. Four of the 24 MacArthur Fellows this year are from Los Angeles. Grantees of the so-called Genius Award were announced last night. They include theater artist Taylor Mack, painter Njideka Akanili Crosby, novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen, and opera director Yuval Sharon. Each will receive the so-called Genius Grant worth $625,000. We'll hear from Viet Thanh Nguyen in a few minutes. But first, Yuval Sharon is with us. He's artistic director of The Industry. That's an experimental opera company here in Los Angeles. Hi, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Madeline. I'm so honored. It's an unbelievable surprise, and I'm still in the process of trying to understand what it is.
Right. So what is it? What is it going to do for you?
First and foremost, it's an incredible, in a way, sign of appreciation for the work that I've been doing in a way that's just overwhelming. Working on things, you're just so, you get in the thicket of it and start really thinking about all the details. You rarely get a chance to step back and think about the impact that your work has. And sometimes you even go, what kind of impact do I have as creating operas? You know, which for so many people, they hear the word opera and they think of it as something that seems so divorced from everyday life and so divorced from things that seem so important. But it's amazing to get this gift and say that, you know, creativity and innovation and pushing boundaries are things that reap their own reward, and sometimes these quite amazing rewards like this.
Yes, incredible.
Quite unbelievably large rewards.
What are you going to do with all that money?
Well, luckily it comes in quarterly installments,
okay.
So I can't just
like
blow it all in one big shopping spree, which, of course, I wouldn't do anyway. Ever since they told me that I was a recipient, I started thinking about what I could do that would be impactful and really meaningful with this very unexpected and very generous gift. And quite honestly, the first thing that I thought of was it really enables me to do something I've been wanting to do actually for a while, which is go take a break and take 6 months, maybe even a year off now. Uh-huh. And just having an opportunity to reflect on the work that I've done and start thinking about what next projects I'd like to be doing. And I hope to also in that time put some of the ideas that I've been exploring in writing and in written format so that it can hopefully continue to inspire other people that are thinking about theater or opera or the performing arts.
Okay, so for people who don't know or are unfamiliar with your name, let's just give them the shorthand. You did Invisible Cities, which was an opera in Union Station, and then you did Hopscotch, which was this incredibly creative approach. You had operas in cars, and people could go around in cars, have opera singers in the cars with them, going to various landmarks in downtown LA where there would be other opera singers. It was really incredible. And
thank you. I'm so glad you were able to see it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And then you have this other opera premiering next month, War of the Worlds, based on, of course, yes, Orson Welles' famous broadcast about aliens invading the Earth. And tell us about that.
We're
really
very excited about that.
Quickly.
I'm really looking forward to that. And actually, in many ways, it feels like the natural next step after a project like Hopscotch or Invisible Cities, in which, you know, a lot of the projects that I've been really interested in exploring are how everyday life and the life of the street and social concerns actually become the content and the experience of these works of art. And the War of the Worlds is kind of a perfect next step in this way, because it's being performed live at Walt Disney Concert Hall, but also broadcast through three World War II era sirens on the streets of Los Angeles, where there are also singers at those sirens that are being broadcast back into the hall. It's fundamentally about the sounds of the street infiltrating the sanctity of the concert hall, in a way kind of attacking that idea of concert halls, opera houses, and music in general being something removed and separated from everyday life.
I love that, because it seems so LA, like something you couldn't do anywhere else but LA.
Well, that's why I moved here, actually. I mean, I moved to Los Angeles because I felt like the environment, the landscape, and the people here really offer that opportunity to explore something that I felt like couldn't happen anywhere else. LA, in many ways, becomes this kind of central character. And the experience of living your life in an urban environment actually becomes such a part of the thematic and conceptual ideas. And so I feel very inspired by this landscape here in Los Angeles. And it's really impacted and helped me develop all these various projects.
Well, Yuval Sharon, congratulations. I'm really excited.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Madeline. It's, I'm very, very overwhelmed and very, very honored.
Yuval Sharon, MacArthur Fellow and Artistic Director of the Industry. That's an LA-based experimental opera company. Now let's hear from writer Viet Thanh Nguyen. We've spoken to him twice about his novels. His debut, The Sympathizer, won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It critiqued how Americans told stories about the Vietnam War. The Refugees came out this February. It's a short story collection about people living between two worlds and switching between various identities. Welcome back to the program and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Okay, how are you feeling about this award?
Well, I've known about it for about a month, but it's still shocking and surprising, especially with all the reactions coming in. Uh-huh. So, yeah, feel honored and humbled all at the same time.
So you've had to keep it a secret this past month?
Yeah, only my wife has known about it. So she's been very patient with me.
Okay, well, $600,000+, that's a lot of money. What do you plan to do with it?
I really don't know. It'll certainly help me to find time to write, and then some portion of it will go towards supporting an arts organization I'm involved with, the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network, and the blog I started with them, which is called diacritics.org. And it's what I think of as the an important space for Vietnamese and Vietnamese diasporic arts, culture, and politics. So I've been too busy to really take care of it for the last year or so, and I will hire an editor to run it for me.
Fantastic. And what are you working on next in terms of a novel?
Working on the sequel to The Sympathizer.
Excellent. And when will that be out?
I have no idea.
I guess you have to finish writing it first.
Right, exactly.
Well, now you have the time and the space to do that. So congratulations.
Thanks again.
Okay, that was Viet Thanh Nguyen, and he's the author of The Sympathizer and The Refugees. I also spoke with Yuval Sharon, director of The Industry. That's an experimental opera company in Los Angeles. They are both now MacArthur geniuses. And a KCRW genius, Christian Bordahl, joins us now.
Wow. I'm going to quit now while
yeah,
I'm ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I have no money to give you, so anyway.
Just the attaboy. Well, we had such a great panel discussion you did at the top of the show today talking about the fallout on the Harvey Weinstein story. So anyone that missed that, I really encourage you to go check it out online at kcrw.com/pressplay. I asked our listeners about the story and the fact that it's not just Harvey Weinstein, it's not just Hollywood, it's powerful men taking advantage of their positions and treating underlings badly. It happens all over the place. Adrenae Gregorian tweeted, "I want to start my list after my experience in Washington, D.C. in my early 20s. Not a surprise to hear that maybe there's some politicians out there. Judith S. Anderson says, "We can't speak up, we can get fired." She says feminist blogger Amanda Marcotte explained the pervasive cultural assumption that women are liars and we all believe it. She says there's a bit of a remedy in a law, AB 569, sitting on Governor Brown's desk right now. It would stop employers from disciplining or firing workers for any reproductive health decisions. She says we need to get laws passed that protect women, at least here in California, because the feds are throwing women under the bus and backing up and running over us again and again.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. Well, we have some other news, and that is there's a live show tonight that you can go to. That's part of our Where Goes the Neighborhood broadcast. Saul Gonzalez will be hosting a live panel. And where is that?
That's at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center, just north of Leimert Park on Washington, a little east of La Brea.
Okay.
And it's at 7 o'clock tonight. Should be really interesting.
Show up and
there you go.
Listen to a great conversation. We're also going to air it on the radio if you can't make it. All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. If you want to reach out to us, Twitter @KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.